TMDL update efforts.
Thank you, Chairman Anderson, members of the board. I'm Matt St. John. Chairman Hales.
Old habits done. You know, I actually take that as a compliment. Thank you, Matt.
Yeah. Sorry. Oops.
I'm not as good looking as he is, though.
You don't look like him, but you're both very handsome.
Good. Yeah, very good save. Not bad.
Did I do good? Did I do good?
Gene, we'll capture that in the minutes, please.
Okay.
But Gene, the minutes are supposed to be accurate.
Yeah. Ouch. You have before you here today the fabulous Russian River Watershed TMDL development team. So I want each of them to introduce themselves and identify their respective roles in this effort.
Charles Reed, engineer here at the board. We met a little earlier.
Rebecca Fitzgerald, good afternoon. I'm going to be project manager for the Laguna TMDL effort.
And I'm Steve Butkus, and I'm the technical assistant for all three projects, doing technical lead on all that.
So yeah, we're here today to give you an update on the status of TMDL development efforts in the Russian River watershed. And following a brief overview of the water quality impairments in the Russian River watershed, we're going to discuss our scope, approach, and schedule for developing three TMDL development projects in the watershed that we're currently working on. I'll cover the discussion of the Reservoirs Mercury TMDL project. Rebecca and Steve will talk about the Laguna de Santa Rosa TMDL project, and Charles and Steve will talk about the Indicator Bacteria TMDL project for the Lower Russian River. As you all know, the starting point is the Federal Clean Water Act 303D list. You'll remember that a little over a year ago, this board adopted what will be the 2010 303D list. State board staff have accepted all of the list as adopted by you for Regional Board 1 and have recommended to the state board to approve Region 1's list. State Board held a workshop a little over a month ago on the statewide 303D list and is scheduled for a hearing in August, at which time it'll go to EPA for approval. So I think we're on track for an EPA approval, a new 2010 303D list, certainly by the end of this calendar year. This table presents the water quality limited segments in the Russian River watershed that represents the list that you have now adopted and will likely soon be the official list. Rather than look at a boring table, show this to you in a map. The entire Russian River watershed is currently on the 303D list for sedimentation, siltation, and temperature. Sure. There are three reservoirs that are listed for mercury impairment, and this is one of the projects that we'll talk about. We include Lake Pillsbury in this because portions of, some of the flow from Lake Pillsbury is diverted to the Russian River. The tributary Big Sulphur Creek is on the 303D list for specific conductivity. The Laguna de Santa Rosa watershed is impaired for nutrients, dissolved oxygen, mercury, and indicator bacteria. Green Valley Creek, just down from the Laguna watershed, is listed for dissolved oxygen and indicator bacteria. And the next series of slides will summarize the indicator bacteria listings for the Lower Russian River watershed, some of which I've already identified. Starting from the north, There's a small tributary to the Russian River at Fitch Mountain, which is impaired for bacteria. Healdsburg Memorial Beach, the Laguna de Santa Rosa watershed, including Santa Rosa Creek, which was listed prior to the listing for the Laguna. Again, Green Valley Creek. And then the most downstream reach is on the mainstem Russian River from the confluence of Fife Creek to Dutchville Creek. In Region 1, we have developed TMDLs in a variety of fashions, and the way that we are grouping the TMDL development projects reflects kind of an evolution of our approach, and I believe it's really a streamlined approach to TMDL development. We're the first project, again, is the Reservoir Mercury TMDL project, and this is a case where it's a common pollutant being addressed for multiple water bodies through a single TMDL project. The Laguna de Santa Rosa TMDL is a single water body where we're addressing multiple pollutants in a given TMDL project. And finally, the Russian River Indicator Bacteria is the third project that we'll discuss today. So I'm going to start with an overview of the Reservoir Mercury TMDL and then move on from there. So the three reservoirs are on the impaired waters list for mercury, and these are drinking water reservoirs, as well as Lake Pillsbury is a power producing facility. As I mentioned earlier, we include Pillsbury as part of these Russian River watershed projects because of the similarity in the nature of that reservoir and the fact that portions of the water are hydrologically connected to the Russian River through a diversion. All three of these listings are based on the fact that there has been mercury levels in fish tissue that exceed standards for human health consumption. In all three of these reservoirs, there have been public health advisories, some of which are official advisories developed by the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment. There was a recent statewide effort looking at pollutants in lakes and reservoirs throughout the state that was developed by our Surface Water Ambient Monitoring Program, and that study was released in May of this year and confirms the impairment in these three reservoirs, showing elevated mercury levels in fish tissue of game size. So our assessment for TMDL development has focused on human health and wildlife protection and involves three basic elements. First, characterizing mercury levels in the reservoirs and their watersheds over time. Quantifying the natural sources as well as anthropogenic sources of total mercury as well as methylmercury in the reservoirs and contributions from the surrounding watershed. And then assessing the linkage between the observed conditions and the conditions that would be needed in order to meet standards and protect the beneficial uses. So to achieve these three components of our analytic approach, we've done monitoring and assessments since 2007. We've collected water samples in the reservoirs as well as in the inflow to the reservoirs and the outflow, measuring for total mercury and methylmercury, as well as measuring fine sediments in the inflow and outflow to attempt to correlate suspended sediment levels to mercury. We've done some surveys of mercury levels in the soils essentially characterizing how much mercury is in the geology of the surrounding area, and done some research to look into the presence of historic mercury mines as well as prospects. So the brief preliminary summary is that there are no, as I characterize it, smoking gun anthropogenic sources of the mercury impairment in these three reservoirs, with the exceptions that we believe, and regional modeling and regional monitoring demonstrates, that there certainly is atmospheric deposition, which includes mercury. In addition, there is one mine, Warm Springs Mine, in Lake Sonoma. This is a historic mine that is now underwater under Lake Sonoma. And we are attempting to work with the Army Corps of Engineers to have some assessment done of the contribution from that underwater, what is now an underwater mine. What we know is that there is mercury in the soils in all three of these watersheds. It's part of the geology, and that we see that there is mercury that's entering the watershed through as part of sediment through erosion. And then it's the physical condition of these reservoirs that's promoting the conversion of mercury to methylmercury, which is the toxic form. And this is a conceptual diagram that hopefully will help to explain this. This was a conceptual model that was developed for a reservoir mercury TMDL project in Region 2, San Francisco Bay region, but it has applicability here. So we'll first bring your attention to the center of the diagram. This is just a depiction of a reservoir, an impoundment, and that in an impounded reservoir system like these three reservoirs, you get summertime stratification, where you get warmer waters at the surface, colder waters at depth, higher dissolved oxygen concentrations closer to the surface, and lower dissolved oxygen concentrations at depth. It is that low dissolved oxygen that allows or promotes a flux of mercury from the sediments and converts it from the total mercury phase to methylmercury, which is the toxic form of mercury. Generally, the approach to addressing this type of a problem in a reservoir is first twofold. You can address the sources to try to eliminate the incoming dissolved mercury so that you don't get that process that makes it into methylmercury, which then bioaccumulates and gets into the fish and becomes a problem. In this case, with the exception of Warm Springs, we don't seem to have mining wastes as the source. These are not urban watersheds, so we don't have mercury coming in as urban runoff. We believe that there is certainly atmospheric deposition, and we know there's contribution from the soils. Which brings us to, you know, if we can address those, that's great, but then there's still this environment created by the reservoirs, and this is a challenge, frankly, to identify the best way to stop this methylation process. Which kind of brings us to our next. Okay, so the next steps, we're continuing to do some data analysis of our monitoring data for purposes of our source assessment. And we have a new student, which we're pleased to have, Andrew Consiglio, who's working with Steve, and Andrew's in the room. And he's working with Steve Butkus to do some data analysis. So we're moving ahead in that regard. A next step to do, which we're not actively working on, is to do some linkage analysis to inform implementation measures. The reason that we're not actively working on this is because there's issues of mercury contaminations in reservoirs is certainly not specific to Region 1, and there's a bunch of regions in the state that are working on reservoir or lake mercury TMDLs. And the TMDL Roundtable has identified an opportunity, perhaps, to develop a single TMDL or policy that would address mercury problems in reservoirs throughout the state. So we are currently kind of somewhat back-burnering this project to and encouraging the development of the statewide effort. With that, I now get to turn it over to Rebecca.
All right. Well, you already saw all my slides. Did you get it all? All right, what I'm going to be talking about this afternoon is the Laguna de Santa Rosa Total Maximum Daily Load Project, which addresses the impairments of nitrogen, phosphorus, dissolved oxygen, sediment, and temperature in the Laguna watershed. A little bit of what I'm going to talk. Thank you very much. Oh, no. Maybe I should not have said that. This is a map of the watershed, just to get everybody tied into where the watershed boundaries are. It includes the cities of Windsor, Santa Rosa, Roanoke Park, Cotati, and Sebastopol, and the tributaries of Windsor Creek and Marquess Creek, Santa Rosa Creek, Copeland Creek, Blucher Creek, and of course the main stem, which starts down here in Cotati, and we're considering it to be the Laguna even up here after the confluence of Marquess Creek and entering into the Russian River main stem. The history of the Laguna, I wanted to spend just a few minutes talking about the listing history with the 303D list. The changes that has happened over time is really unique and I think quite fascinating. The history kind of reflects California's as well as the nation's changing approaches to addressing water quality limited segments, and from regulations that focus primarily on point sources to addressing non-point source control issues as well. The Laguna was included on our first 303D list in 1976. It was the only water body in the region to be so listed. By the early 1990s, it was listed for ammonia and dissolved oxygen, and it was for those two parameters that the waste reduction strategy was developed, and that was completed by Regional Water Board staff in 1995. And that was our first TMDL. It included load allocations for total ammonia and total nitrogen. So it was kind of another historic moment for us. And I'm going to be talking more in a few slides about that waste reduction strategy. Because the strategy was completed, the Laguna was delisted in 1998 by the EPA. Also that year, during that listing cycle, it was listed as sediment impaired as part of the larger Russian River sediment listing. In 2002, the Laguna was again listed on the 303D list, this time for nitrogen, phosphorus, and dissolved oxygen. Basically, monitoring showed that there continued to be exceedances of water quality objectives. Also in 2002, the Laguna was listed as temperature impaired. Again, that was part of the larger Russian River temperature listing. And then 2006, it was listed for mercury, and this last round, indicator bacteria. So the impairments that we are looking at today are included here, the nutrients, DO, temp, and sediment. Our current TMDL effort is focused on those top five. Charles is going to be talking in a little bit about the indicator bacteria pathogen effort, which is going to be more Russian River-wide. So what have we done so far about the Laguna's impairments? As I already mentioned, the waste reduction strategy was completed in 1995, and that was basically our first TMDL. Although Regional Board staff developed it and the EPA approved it as meeting TMDL development requirements in 1995, we never amended it into the basin plan as an action plan like some of the other TMDLs that you're familiar with. The waste reduction strategy focused primarily on nitrogen in regards to ammonia toxicity. It did not focus on phosphorus. The thought was that since nitrogen was primarily coming from non-point sources, the control of those sources would also result in reductions in total ammonia and total phosphate, organic matter, and also improve dissolved oxygen conditions. It did set loads and load reductions for total ammonia and total nitrogen, both on an interim and a final basis. The implementation plan that was in the waste reduction strategy is summarized there on the slide, basically to reduce sources of nitrogen and ammonia from dairies, from urban stormwater runoff, and also from the wastewater treatment plant. And then also there was the focus even then of working really closely with the stakeholders. At the time, it was primarily the Laguna crimp. So what happened after the strategy was completed? Did it work? Did it improve water quality? It's kind of a yes and no answer. Ammonia levels dropped thanks to improvements at the wastewater treatment plant and at local dairies. The interim goals for total ammonia and total nitrogen were attained in the late 1990s. And because the Laguna had the strategy as its TMDL, the EPA went ahead and delisted it. However, in the early 2000s, it was obvious that water quality was still poor in the Laguna. It was relisted in 2002, like I just mentioned, for nitrogen, phosphorus, and DO. DO levels were very low, and the US EPA concluded that nitrogen and phosphorus levels far exceeded those associated with excessive aquatic plant growth, and that the water quality standard for biostimulatory substances were violated. It's interesting to note that the waste reduction strategy's focus on nitrogen was primarily based on analyses linked to protecting beneficial uses from an ionized ammonia toxicity, not biostimulatory algal productivity, not the plant growth that's out there. And the strategy was also limited in that it did not specifically analyze dissolved oxygen. And so we continue to adapt, and we're working on another TMDL for the Laguna, one that will address the nutrients, the phosphorus and the nitrogen again, dissolved oxygen, and also include the sediment and temperature impairments as well. I'm going to hand the mic over to Steve now, and he's going to talk a little bit about how we're going to try to identify all the sources.
Okay, where we're at right now with the development of this TMDL is where we are in the source analysis. And a source analysis is an element of the TMDL where we inventory all relevant sources to the problem. We have to assess all point, non-point, and background, natural background sources in that assessment, and we try to find and quantify, if possible, the relative magnitude of all of those sources that we find. So with the three projects that we're working on with this TMDL, for the temperature constituent, we are doing a sensitivity analysis, which is a modeling exercise, looking at representative lake and stream reaches within the Laguna watershed to really determine whether or not the same factors that we've seen throughout the region, and you saw Brian's talk this morning, are the same factors that are primarily at work here in the Laguna. If those factors tend to be the same, we can really rely on that development of that policy and all of the prior work in temperature to push this TMDL forward. We really don't need to be reinventing the wheel much. We just need to assure ourselves that those relationships still stand in this part. For sediment, we're relying heavily on a sediment budget study done by the Army Corps of Engineers after some of the floods that occurred down about 5 years ago in the Laguna area. They came in and did a lot of hired PWA to do a full sediment budget of the Laguna, the different tributaries and all that. Our review of that work says it suggests that there's sufficient data within that assessment to actually help develop and advise load allocations and further implementation. So we don't really see having to do a lot additional modeling or assessment work with the sediment, relying heavily on that Army Corps study. Which leads us to the nutrients and DO issues, and that's where our primary focus has been in this development. And we're looking at it from an empirical approach mostly, and looking at a number of lines of evidence approach. The lagoon is a very complex system. We looked at recommendations prior to how to approach these kinds of problems. Some of them recommend very complex models. Others recommend going simple. It's always best to look at a lot of different approaches to an issue, and not rely on a single model or a single approach. And so that's our attempt here. I'll talk a little bit more about that nutrient source analysis. Really, we've divided up into a couple of steps. One is to look at the spatial distribution of the loading across the full watershed of the laguna. So in 2008, we did nutrient sampling of all the major tributaries, and this was summer sampling, the dry weather only, throughout the laguna. A lot of the previous work had looked at specific sources, but not regionally across, relationship of what the loading is from Marquess Creek to a number of the other tributaries. And so that was one of the steps we did to get an overall view of what's coming off the landscape. And then in 2009 and partly 2010, we did sampling of seven general land use classes. We used the USGS current land use, land cover stuff, and divided up into the seven general classes. They do break it down further, but we worked in, forest versus urban versus cropland, those kind of major categories. And we sampled wet and dry samples from areas that were draining a predominance of that land use to try to get land use specific loadings from the different types of loadings from specific types of land uses. We're looking at those seven land use classes. The lines of evidence that we're using are the sampling that we did in the tributaries in 2008, the specific land use runoff sampling that was done in 2009. There's a lot of published literature out there that people have looked at the same sorts of things. You have to be really conscious about, making sure that they're representative of this area and this climate, and so you do have to filter through the literature, and just we're using that just in a comparison sense to make sure, how are we doing compared to other nationally or other areas that are the same region as far as land use loadings. The original TMDL, actually, the modeling that was done derived estimates of loadings from several of these land uses that we're also looking. And another thing that's not up there is we're also looking at some simple watershed models, more mechanistic complex models, and this one is GWLF. It's a USDA form of a model that can also predict land use. So the approach here is to look at measured values, what's in the science, what can be modeled, and look at the range of conditions so that we can focus in on what's really happening in this watershed. The other approach we're looking at is we're comparing what's coming off these land uses in the landscape now to what potentially came off in historical times. So we're trying to compare these loadings to what happened prior to European settlement in the area. Just as a point of reference, it's not necessarily, it may advise how we derive the allocations, trying to go for more bang for the buck, where we're going to get the best amount of reduction in certain areas. So we'll use that as a point of reference. So we're developing these land cover maps for prior to the European settlement, generally in the 1850s, actually the 1600s when the Spanish first came in. And we're preparing these maps using historical maps. There's a lot of 1877 atlases in those ranges. We have the public surveyor notes from the 1860s when they actually dragged the chains across the landscape and they recorded what kinds of trees were at particular bearing points, and there's a lot of really good information. Soil surveys can tell you what kind of vegetation should predominate an area that may have been perturbed at this point. And there was some initial historical mapping done by David Smith Consulting in 1990 that we are also including in this process. And these are some graphics to show little bit on how this is done. So this is the 1877 historical atlas of Sonoma County,
and we have in black overlaid the boundary of the Laguna watershed. So we can go and look at these old maps and pull up the features and rectify exactly where those maps set in the current landscape and pull that into GIS tools. And you can do things like this. You can look at what did the stream layer look before and what does it look like now, and compare those different times. And so here's a map that shows the 1877 hydrology overlaid with the current hydrology layers, the different stream layers. And I wanted to point out a couple of features you see in this. For instance, the top line points out the relocation of Mark West Creek several miles south over historic times. While they captured the farmland in that area right here, they actually captured this river and moved it south to this point where it was originally up here, so that this land in here could be reclaimed. There used to actually be a lake called Ballard Lake in there. The second thing that you can see, which is one of the issues with the lagoon and the hydrology, is everything's been channelized. You see a lot of these straight channels when before it was really braided, running through a whole wetland network that would process the pollutants and reduce them. And now we just shoot it straight down through these channels right out. Delivers the sediment fast, it doesn't process it. So you can get some pretty good information from some of these historical maps and doing this kind of historical hydrology. And then from these maps, you can come up with the conceptual models. And here's sort of a conceptual model of prior to settlement and after settlement. And this is out of the conceptual model report that was done by the foundation. And Rebecca will talk about that next. But from the lakeside, you have, I went backwards. This is the lake. It used to be a huge lake out there. It's amazing how much open water there was. They used to recreate, go down there. There were salmon they fished out of that place. And this is kind of how the tributaries and the marshlands around it would look as they drained through, and they did all of this filtration into this larger open water system. As development occurred and we channelized the streams and whatnot, the sediment got delivered, lakes got filled in, filtration capacity of the surrounding wetlands and whatnot reduced such so that this is more what we see today in the open water, and these are sort of our channels, our tributaries draining to it, versus this kind of thing, what we saw in the turn of the century. That's actually 1900 right there, Lake Honeave. The next steps in this is to do a linkage analysis. What kind of response do we get dissolved oxygen-wise from these different loadings, comparing these different things? We're going to, again, look at modeling representative lake and stream reaches within the system. We've done some initial work on this, and it is very challenging because the Laguna really is not a lake or stream networks. It really is a wetland complex. And a lot of your commonly used water quality models are set up for a little bit different kinds of geometries and whatnot than we see. For instance, a simple stream model like Qual2K that's been used previously there, you know, really wouldn't work with the data we collected in 2008 because we had zero flow going through there. And the lake sizes were basically a series of little puddles. So a lot of the current hydrology and stuff, the way the system is working, doesn't lend use of common water quality models. So we're looking at a number of different empirical approaches as well. We'll assess the sensitivity during these critical conditions. You have a situation where a lot of your loading is occurring in the wintertime through your wet weather, but your critical conditions when we're having the dissolved oxygen impacts and whatnot are during the hot summer thing. So we really do have to look at wet and dry periods in the assessment. And then we'll use sort of as a guide what kind of land use or loadings we had pre-settlement to help us look at what kind of targets. You know, certainly we probably can't get back to pre-settlement conditions, but that knowing where it was and what kind of functions were on the landscape will help us advise the implementation to help achieve these targets.
And that brings it back to me again. In addition to the great data that we're getting through our source analysis that Steve's working on, we're really fortunate in this watershed to have a lot of research and documents already prepared that's been developed over the last few years. These are four in particular that we're finding very useful, and I wanted to sort of give a nod to today. One is the history, land uses, and natural resources of the Laguna that Dave W. Smith Consulting put together. This is the sediment sources rate and fate that Philip Williams and associates, put together on behalf of the Army Corps. And Steve mentioned that has some sediment budget information that's really going to help with our sediment analysis portion. At least I'm not the only one having problems today with this. The Laguna Foundation put together this great document, Enhancing and Caring for the Laguna. And then we're also using the Altered Laguna, which is a series of conceptual models that the Laguna Foundation and Tetra Tech and Philip Williams and Associates were involved with, along with Regional Water Board staff. So I wanted to mention those in part because some of the conclusions from these documents and from the work and research that has already been done in the watershed, I wanted to highlight here because there's some of the next steps that have been identified in the Laguna. They include, as you can imagine, reducing the nutrient load going into the Laguna as well as the sediment load, and then also looking at some restoration of what some of that historical hydrology might have been like, perhaps reconfiguring some stream channels, and certainly restoring wetlands where possible, getting back to those open water lakes, perennial and seasonal wetlands and marshes, vernal pool restoration and preservation, regrowing the riparian vegetation, not just along the main stem, but along the tributaries as well. It's going to be key for both sediment and temperature. And then also there's a lot of discussion about removing invasive plants like the Luigia that's out there. And this information is providing us with some guidance on early implementation efforts. Some of these early implementation tasks are kind of listed here. And these are measures, by the way, that are already ongoing in the watershed. The City of Santa Rosa is actively working on wastewater nutrient offset programs, just starting to. Obviously, we have our urban stormwater permit that was recently approved here by your board a few months ago. We're working on our dairy permitting right now. And there's been a lot of restoration activities also in the Laguna by the Laguna de Santa Rosa Foundation, the city, the resource conservation districts, and others, the landowners. There's quite a community involved in this watershed, which brings me right into the stakeholder involvement piece. As I'm sure you know, what needs to be done in the Laguna is not something that we can do in a vacuum here. We are just but one organization, and there is such a large community in this watershed that has been so deeply active and has a history and is really committed to seeing, you know, improvements in the water quality, that we want to be a part of that and to bring them into our TMDL development process. To that end, we've developed a stakeholder plan. We recently just put it up on our website. The address is there for anybody who's interested. Our goal with our stakeholder outreach is, you know, it's communication. Make sure that we're getting across to all the stakeholders, you know, what the TMDL process is all about, what the regional board is all about, trying to summarize our sediment source data and the approach that we're doing and the conclusions that we find, and also to bring them in very actively in the development of our implementation plan. We want to and hope to solicit and receive relevant and useful information and get community support and buy-in, especially, again, for our implementation efforts as we go forward. We hope to do this by by taking the steps that are here, perhaps the most important part of our outreach efforts are going to be the stakeholder meetings. At least that's what I suspect will be the most effective. We're really going to try to meet with the community individually or with, you know, groups of like-minded interests. This is going to be the municipalities, the industry groups, environmental groups, the NGOs, the landowners, really try to work closely with them. We're going to be holding these meetings throughout the TMDL development process, but we're probably going to do most of them starting this fall once we are a little bit further with our source analysis and we have some more data that we can share and really start discussing some implementation options. In addition, of course, we'll have our webpage up, all the latest news and contact information, that sort of thing. We have a database of interested parties, so we can email and hard copy mail out fact sheets we're going to be working on. We'll probably be back in front of you every 6 months, unless you're tired of us and don't want to see us that often. And of course, we'll be bringing this out for a full public review of the draft documents and public comment like we always do. Our schedule is up here. Like I mentioned, stakeholder involvement is going to be ongoing. We hope to have the source analysis, the technical piece, the draft of the TMDL and load allocations all done by the end of this year. And then we're next year really going to start working on implementation. And then hopefully bring it out to peer review next summer. One of the dates that's up there, November of 2011, is when the Santa Rosa wastewater permit renewal will happen. And I just wanted to say that our TMDL technical analysis will be completed in enough time to have the information that we think is necessary to advise in that wastewater permit renewal process. And I think with that, I'm going to turn it over to Charles.
Don't worry, we're almost done. So Steve and I are going to wrap up the TMDL presentation with the pathogen TMDL portion. I'm going to give you a little background on the beneficial use impairments and describe some of the organisms of interest in this TMDL. I'll turn it back to Steve, who's going to describe the UC Davis pilot study that is recently completed. He'll also go over the TMDL monitoring plan that we have in store for you. And I'll come back and talk about some potential early implementation opportunities, and then I'll give you an idea of what schedule we think we're going to be able to meet here. So based on results from beach monitoring for bacteria and first flush monitoring, we've determined that the beneficial uses for water contact recreation and shellfish are currently impaired. The impairment is focused on a number of watersheds and sections of the Russian River. They're listed here in the slide for you. These were talked about a little bit earlier on, so I won't dwell on them. In addition, this map is a repeat from earlier, but you can see where the reaches and the watersheds that are currently impaired. So at the heart of the matter is that there are organisms in the surface water that are causing disease and leading to impairment of beneficial uses. And the causative agents of human gastrointestinal illnesses are the ones in the first bullet here. Oops. They're grouped in bacteria, protozoa, viruses, and helminths. And those are the nasty critters out there that are causing actually the disease. But there are limits, there are limitations to trying to detect those in the environment. They're difficult to isolate. The detection methods are costly. They're time-consuming. It takes quite a while, days to weeks sometimes, to get results back. And these organisms are often present in very low numbers. So what's been happening since the early 60s is health professionals have been using indicator organisms to indicate the presence of fecal contamination in surface water. Now, these indicators themselves are not pathogenic, but they're merely there to indicate the presence of fecal contamination. And these organisms are fairly common to you. You've heard the terms fecal coliform bacteria, E. coli, and Enterococcus before. These are the indicator organisms that we use to detect the presence of fecal contamination and, by extension, these pathogenic microorganisms. And these organisms form the basis of the impairment. Let me go back here for a minute. Now, the uses of indicator organisms go back, like I said, to the 1960s. It's fairly old technology. They're fairly well accepted, but they have their own limitations. They're not source specific, and in some cases, they still take 1 to 2 days to get results. Fortunately, there's new technology out there that is very rapid and is very source specific. And that flows into Steve's presentation, because the UC Davis project talks about that, and we'll be using some of these new methods in the TVMDL monitoring. So I'll turn it over to Steve.
Thanks, Charles. Like Charles said, that the indicator bacteria that we're using, they're really good for determining whether or not there's a fecal presence or a possibility of having these pathogenic organisms out there. But they're not good for source matching. You don't know where it came from. They could come from any kind of animal, the wildlife, decomposing animals. They can regrow in the algae in the banks and then resuspend in the next year. So it's just using the fecal indicator bacteria doesn't tell you where it's coming from. It's very difficult to do that. Recently, there's been a lot of new methods coming out in what they call microbial source tracking approaches. And they tend to look at other organisms and different things. Because of that widespread new type technology out there, we contracted with UC Davis to sort of look at all of the suite of MST methods that are being used out there, and then basically come up with a recommendation on how we should focus for the Russian River specifically. Because what you can use in Southern California beaches may not be different for these kind of situations with different landscapes, different kinds of sources, and different kinds of climates. They came back with monitoring recommendations for our TMDL program development. One is to really increase the number of locations that we monitor. We have very limited monitoring that has caused the listings, some first flush monitoring here and there, and then basically the beach monitoring that we do on the summers, but really not enough to really give us a good handle of the spatial extent of the problem throughout the watershed. Increase the number of frequency, and in particular during wet periods. We've been doing a lot of summer monitoring. That's when the recreational use is impacted. But we also need to know what's coming in off the landscape during the storm events to help track some of this. Sampling variability was an issue. We tend to, because of cost, grab one sample. Well, measurement of indicator bacteria in the environment is a highly variable game. And that one sample, we really don't know what the variance is around there. Is that sample plus or minus 10%, you know, or log order magnitudes? So we need to really assess that variability of what happens when we do collect a sample. What does that sample really mean? Then they also recommend looking at the different types of land uses that are influenced, and then analyze for this new bacteria called Bactroides, that methods are now being developed that can quantify that and quantify it for specific host animals and I'll talk about that, plus use stable isotope analysis of nitrate. And then that is another track method, and I'll talk about both of those. Bactroides bacteria are a little bit different than the fecal indicator bacteria. They still come from the intestines of warm-blooded animals, but they're very short-lived in the environment, and they don't really regrow. So you have, when you measure Bactroides and quantify it, you have essentially fresh fecal material that you're assessing there. There's genetic markers in those that are specific to the host animal, and so we can use this qPCR approach to distinguish between fecal sources of humans versus cows versus canines versus birds. And so that's one of the reasons it's a very host-specific organism that we can see where is this fecal material coming from. The other thing is to look at these stable isotope analysis. Bacterial nitrification uses heavy and light oxygen and heavy and light nitrogen differently in the processes. And from looking at the ratio of heavy to light oxygen and heavy to light nitrogen, you can tell what the source of the water, whether or not it's come from a manure source, runoff from the surface, or gone through septic systems. And so we're using that as a tracer of the source of the water that's carrying the fecal material. So those are the two new approaches that we're going to try in this process, in this project. The management questions of the TMDL monitoring plan that we're putting in place, are the objectives being met? We have, you know, limited data that says, yeah, it does not look like they're being met. That's why they're on the list. We're trying to get a lot more information to look at that variability and all of that. The variability is the important question here. When you're having a single sample, you just really don't know what that sample means, because these organisms are highly variable in the environment and through the laboratory analytical processes. What are the most significant sources? What are the natural background levels? And are beach areas a higher risk than other areas in the watershed? So those are the monitoring questions our monitoring plan is focused on. For the fecal indicator bacteria, we are doing a lot of collection of the traditional methods. That's what our basin plan is written on. That's what beach postings are done. They're not as useful in source tracking, but they do answer that big question of, are the objectives being met? Is there potential risk? We've used commercial labs in the past. There's limitations to commercial labs in the sense that they like to work Monday through Thursdays. You can deliver the sample such. So there's a lot of, we can't look at storm event issues because these labs aren't open. We can't look at things that occur on the weekend when you have your highest use. We're looking at putting in a laboratory here to do an analysis of the call alert and the inter alert samples. It allows us to do that storm event and weekend work and actually assess what's going on during those times. Analysis cost is a third of what the state contract lab cost if we do it in-house, so we can do three times more sample. And the more samples with highly variable indicators like this, the better answer you're going to get. And we got Sonoma County Health, who's partnering with us, doing the quality assurance on the work that we do in our own lab. We're also doing Bactroides work. We're contracting with Sonoma County Health to do those Bactroides. We don't have a quantitative PCR here, but we have a contract with UC Davis to help them establish that. So we actually have that capability of doing Bactroides work within this basin with our local partner. And then we're also going to do stable isotope analysis of the nitrates that are in the waters that we're sampling through the UC Davis stable isotope facility. There is another brand new technology that came out, and it's called the PhyloChip. And in fact, the commercial lab just opened last week, I believe, for business. It's a new technology developed by Berkeley National Lab with Homeland Security funding. When 9/11 happened, they had to come in and figure out how to analyze for these horrible pathogens in the air and all of this quickly and quantify it. They put a lot of money in it, and they came up with this chip system that is rapid, repeatable. They're using it for all kinds of stuff up here at Sonoma County Health. They have to open up letters and test for all of these things using these methods. Well, anyway, the PhyloChip allows you to quantify over 50,000 different organisms in a single sample, everything. And so, like, for Enterococcus, which is one of our parameters, it gives us 364 different species of Enterococcus and quantifies them. So it allows you to assess the entire biome. And what it's doing, what it does is it also allows you to actually measure the human pathogens, some of those that you are concerned about. It won't measure the viruses, but the bacterial human pathogens it will. And they're applying it here recently in Richardson Bay, Prop 50 Clean Beaches projects internationally. So it's a technology that's brand new on the cusp, and it can really help with the source identification. We are currently looking for funding to include this technology in our TMDL monitoring plan as well. I'm going to move it on back to Charles for.
So as you can guess, this pathogen TMDL has the potential to be fairly complicated, complex using these new methods and organisms. And that'll proceed along its path. But in the meantime, the staff believes there are some potential opportunities to do some early implementation of the TMDL. And for this slide, I've kind of organized them into groups of things we might want to look at, regulatory measures that we already have in our toolbox to implement the TMDLs. I suspect we'll be doing a lot of public outreach to improve water quality the best we can while the TMDLs are being developed. And we hope to outreach to the regulated community as well. So we hope to be pursuing these as we move our way through the TMDL process. So this is a schedule we're estimating at the time. We hope to, budget permitting, get to do some monitoring this summer and finish up by the fall of 2011. After that, through June 2012, we hope to be actually doing the TMDL, and including lots of public participation in the process, and have something to you to consider in 2013. And this slide is all our contact information. We hope to be updating the web page when we have new information. And this is how you can reach all of us. And that concludes this presentation, I believe.
All right. Thank you very much. The summary of a whole lot of things going on.
Thanks for your patience.
Yeah, of course. No, we appreciate it. And, you know, we know that this has been in its developmental stages, and, you know, it's nice insight to see the spectrum of what you're looking at. And there's been a lot of concerns raised by other folks during public testimony, and this is a nice way to share that, you know, you're actually addressing and covering a lot of those. So thanks for sharing that. Do we have any board member questions? John.
I just had one on the PhyloChip, and basically where you're trying to distinguish between fecal coliform. That's been possible for a long time, but the costs were just a killer. Is part of the new technology is that it lowers the cost?
Actually, the cost is estimated currently at about $1,000 a sample, which
okay,
is extremely
high.
One. But that's because they are doing all 50,000 organisms in the biome. What they're trying to do is develop another chip that would be specific for water issues, where maybe they can focus in on the 20 or so really bad bugs out there that are really the indicators. And they're doing some multivariate analysis of these other samples to try to tease out what are those specific organisms, and then they could create another chip that only looks at, say, 200 or so, and that will drop the cost significantly, and it will also increase the turnaround time so you can get a faster sample. So,
sounds real exciting.
Yeah, it is.
Mr. Chair, in terms of of sampling for the bacteria, we've focused on the Monterio area and Healdsburg area, but there's an immense amount of river in between there. Are we doing anything in terms of sampling those areas? And obviously, for me, the specific area from Mirabel to Guerneville.
Well, what I can say is that our monitoring plan is addressing a geographic area that is much larger than just those listed reaches in the main stem, as well as the entire Laguna watershed and further up into the watershed that comes into Fitch Mountain area. With respect to those main stem locations, Steve can elaborate, but we're primarily focusing on those recreation beach areas. Mm-hmm. Are there any other?
Not along the Russian.
Not
in terms of dealing specifically with septics, it's amazing, but people are beginning to say, yeah, there's human coliform in the beaches, but if you go up the river, it's all ducks and weasels.
Beach assessment where we're looking at measuring these constituents, the Bacteroides and stuff, at a beach site, going upstream of the beach site where there is not active recreation, and then going downstream approximately the same distance where there is not active recreation again to see whether, and we're getting enough samples in those assessments to determine whether or not there's statistical differences between those collections.
Thank you. That's the information.
And at those locations, we're monitoring, we'll be taking samples that will be analyzed for these various analytic tools, the Bacteroides, the stable isotopes, in addition to just the standard indicator bacteria. So we'll be able to answer those questions, not only the spatial differences, but also really getting at the source tracking. Is it of human origin, cows, or kind of other?
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman? hi.
Mr. Rivera.
And I thought it was God first.
In your case, it would be left field, yes.
Please.
I just wanted to add to the discussion of the phylochip. The technology is one of those, it has a wow factor to it. But at the same time, it promises to inform our decisions here in a way that is novel yet quite of high quality and with a range of information that will assist us in the process that we're about to undertake here. To that end, we sought funding from the state board through the cleanup and abatement account. We were turned down this week. The reason being that the state board is not funding these type of activities out of the cleanup and abatement account because it's not a cleanup function, because it's for monitoring. So to that end, we have a few options. We may appeal to the state board directly or otherwise, seek a plan B. And for that, I'm engaged on and will report back to you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Norton.
I want to thank you guys for one for coming up today and bringing us up at least to date. A couple questions. Can you share a little bit about the UC Davis investigation? Is that something that did happen, and is it something that's out there, or is it premature to talk about that?
Well, I can say some things.
It's at your discretion, Matt.
It is a draft report, and it's not been finalized yet, and we're currently working with the UC Davis researchers to finalize the report so that we can share it with you and the rest of the public. The draft report, in addition to providing the monitoring recommendations that Steve went over, makes the fundamental conclusion that there is widespread and persistent presence of human pathogens that are pathogens that are largely of human origin. predominantly human origin throughout the watershed. A pretty striking finding. I should say that we have shared the draft report with the county health officer and the county environmental health, which they very much appreciated. So we're currently working with UC Davis to try to get that report finalized. Concurrently, they're in the process of submitting a manuscript to a peer-reviewed journal, which really is going to be to our benefit, frankly, to have a peer-reviewed journal that goes through that scientific review process that we can really stand behind that work. So we're holding off finalizing the report until we move a little bit further down the road on that.
Okay. The other thing would be we're almost going to be to the point here of looking at another 303D list pretty quick, I would imagine, or at least look at the listing and all that kind of stuff. The last time that came around, one comment I had is that I was kind of surprised that some of the data, the age of the data, the space in between some of those data sets, sometimes the paucity of the data, some of just the limitations of that. Steve, I'm actually, you know, you seem to be the sample guy here. And so from that standpoint, through something like a TMDL development where this is just kind of getting off the ground, from a developing a sampling program then to, can you shed light on that? How do you do that, and how do you specifically get to, and it kind of goes with Bill's question, you know, that there's data and then there's data, you know, there's those grab samples that we get on first flush, and, you know, that's what you get on first flush, but that's not maybe, those are snapshots. Those aren't necessarily what's going on out there 24/7 every day. And, you know, so how do you go about then in having a rigorous and defendable and representative sample set here on a very complex system, granted, that has everything from weasels, apparently, to, sorry, Bill, but, you know, a rather large human footprint where the last TMDL we did, obviously, was the Klamath, and it's just kind of the polar opposite of Klamath to me. You know, I live on the Laguna, by the way. I'm down in Sebastopol, and the Laguna is quite interesting, you know, especially when you get out there and muck around in it a little bit. You know, it's fascinating out there. But can you shed some light just on the sampling and how you go about thinking and doing that?
Well, I agree that the listing and the way the policy is presented for our listings, we do have a lot of listings based on limited data. And, you know, the listing is to make us aware of there's probably an issue here. There's a risk. You know, we have some indication of that. The TMDL is the next step to really assess the full amount of that risk. And so that's one of the reasons why we're trying to do our own laboratory here. We can get three times the samples for the same cost.
Right.
What we need is a lot of replication of the data, of the sampling that we do. That was one of the biggest recommendations coming from UC Davis, is we're going out there and grabbing a single sample. Well, and you're measuring that sample against a standard, whether or not you're going to post on that beach. Well, that sample, that one grab sample, could be plus or minus 50%.
Well, the other part of it is,
without knowing the variability of your sampling, it's you post on you know, conservative approach. You get some kind of hit. We better, you know, we don't know. So why we're doing all this additional sampling is to really address that kind of an issue.
Yeah. And by the way, I support that because, you know, from the standpoint, I think data sets you free. But the thing is once something is listed, the delisting policy is equally as rigorous and as hard to get off of that list. That's the list that keeps on giving.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's very difficult because, you know, we saw some of the potential twists and turns in that AB 885, you know, the septic rigs and the implications maybe that come with that. And that's not to be taken lightly, you know. And I would ask that I know it's money. Data is all about money and getting out there on the ground, taking samples and mm-hmm. replicating and having great QAQC, and so I'm sure you try and balance that. Of course, I'm an advocate for data, you know, and good data, representative data, data that's in fact the best we can get to support this, because I think truly there surely is impairment out there. I mean, it's pretty clear. It's very, very clear. But at the same time, you know, I guess looking at it from here, I would also ask staff to kind of look at, and I try myself to, you know, I stand at my place sometimes, and I've got that 1877 atlas. I use it for my work, and it's fascinating. In fact, I read the Laguna history, and it's really fascinating. And, You know, it's hard to kind of think about what that thing was like 1,000 years ago, you know, and there's kind of no going back. But I think what's kind of an interesting exercise is think about, well, what does it look like going forward? Well, what does this thing look like unimpaired? What does that mean, unimpaired out here? We're not going to kick the cows off the land, I don't think. We're not going to undo the cities and the streets and the urban contribution or the rural contribution. But what does that look like? And that's just a kind of question I always kind of check myself with. And how do we get there? So this is a great place to start from. I think you guys are, you know, really coming at this well. And again, I think data is super important. The way that you're thinking about it now and to hear you say that, I think is really good. So I really support that.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Massey.
I can't help myself, Matt. You said it's a draft. It's going back for finalizing. Do we have a timetable?
How
the
do
simple
I say
answer
this?
Is no at the moment.
Well, it's hard to know because, frankly, I mean, I'll just put it straightforward.
Yeah.
The Davis researchers, what they're interested in at this point is getting their work published in a manuscript. And they've run out of money in our contract. They're not particularly interested in spending time to get the report, our report, to a place where it's, to put it in simple terms, is kind of user-friendly. Mm-hmm. It's a very dense report, as researchers often are. And one of our concerns has been, when this becomes available, we want it to be accessible.
Yes.
To folks to be able to understand it. So what we attempted to do, we're attempting to get some additional of our TMDO contract money to be the incentive to have the researchers to do some reworkings. It's nothing, the analysis has been done, the figures have been generated, but we need them to spend a little bit more time telling the story that's frankly in a little bit more of a user-friendly layman's terms. But they aren't going to do that without some additional funds. So at this point, we're having to kind of carve out some of our TMDO contract funds that we hoped to go to our source assessment mm-hmm. and linkage analysis, and we're having to devote it to finalizing this report. That's probably more than you needed to hear, but it is why I can't give you a time frame, because it is somewhat dependent on the researchers' availability as well as us being able to get money out of our legislature.
I appreciate that, and I appreciate the vagaries that go with it because of the research process that we go through. It is in the sense that there's rumors all over the place, as I'm sure we're all aware, and it isn't until we have that actual thing that you can say, look, here it is. This is the...
And what I can tell you is that what I have talked with Kat and Luis and David is what I plan to do is to have a separate meeting, public meeting, that would be held jointly with the Sonoma County Environmental Health to roll out this study once it truly is publicly available. So I'm hoping that could be sometime late fall or next winter.
I recognize the frustration that everybody goes through, and thank you very much for all of you. You're doing this is good stuff. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Dean?
This area, you know, has a population of over 600,000 people. It's our biggest urban area that this board deals with. And so there's so many different stakeholders from ag, dairy, timber, urban, agriculture, rural, and to try and cover all of those point and non-point sources and activities that are going to contribute is quite mind-boggling. And I think when I saw what you were listing here, you were listing a lot of it, and it's going to take a lot of cooperation from a lot of stakeholders. And I think this is a good start to identify the impairments and some of the sources for it. So I look forward to getting updates on this.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I have a couple of speaker cards. David Bannister, followed by Dave Smith.
David Bannister with the Laguna Foundation. I'd just like to briefly thank the board and staff for their interest and support for the Laguna TMDL and all the work that's gone into it. Commissioner Noren, particularly, thanks for your interest in, and you know, personal interest in the Laguna. I'd like to, as sort of a manager, I'd jump right to the report recommendations and highlights. The slide that talked about recommending nutrient load reduction, sediment reduction, historic hydrology restoration, wetland preservation and restoration, riparian preservation and restoration, and the invasive plant Ludwigia hexapetala removal. And I would just say that the Laguna Foundation supports every one of those, and we're actually involved in many of them, and particularly are interested in the, and have recently started the wheels turning on another Ludwigia hexapetala task force, and we'll be in contact, of course, with your board and staff to get your participation in it. We already have support from Representative Woolsey's office, City of Santa Rosa, City of Rohnert Park, and the board of a couple of members of the Board of Supervisors, and have met with Water Agency and are involved in looking at some grant opportunities to try and address this. We've already applied for a National Fish and Wildlife Federation grant to get the wheels turning. 5 years ago, we did a project that was addressed on that plant that was addressed more towards short-term results, addressing the concern about West Nile virus. And it was successful in the short term, but now we'd like to look at a longer-term ecosystem-based approach that will hopefully have long-term results. But it'll probably be a long-term plan as well, not a two-year plan like we did last time. So anyway, I just want to say that we support the efforts that you highlighted here and for the Laguna TMDL, and look forward to working with you in the future to accomplish those results.
Thank you. Mr. Smith, followed by Daniel Myers.
Good afternoon, Chairman Hales and members of the board. My name is Dave Smith, and I'm here on behalf of the City of Santa Rosa. I guess I want to start out by commending the staff for that presentation. That was most impressive, and it's wonderful to see the staff diving into this issue and bringing along with it all the new technology that can help out. I did want to draw your attention to one issue that I'm concerned about, and that is referring to a report that I wrote as historical in nature. on a personal level, that doesn't necessarily feel very good.
Three for him.
But otherwise, in full concurrence with the staff's presentation. The nexus that the city has, of city interest with this TMDL, are substantial. The city is a major stormwater discharger to the Laguna, recycled water discharger in some years, and the recycled water that we produce for reuse is used by entities that are going to be affected by the TMDL as well. So I just wanted to point out that we have a big stake in the outcome, and the city has historically on matters related to water quality regulation and other environmental regulations played a constructive role in the process, has sought policies and regulations and permits that and supported implementation of those that protected beneficial uses, and has sought at all times to comply with regulations. And I think the city is going to take this very same approach to participation in the TMDL process. And we look forward to working with your staff on that. We have extensive data and experience studying the Laguna, and we look forward to sharing that with staff. So thanks for taking your time to look at this issue today, and we look forward to working with you and staff on it.
Thanks, Dave.
I'll pass.
Okay. I have it.
Okay.
Come on down.
I want to echo what all the others said about my appreciation for this whole process and for the work being done by staff. I really feel this is a large endeavor, and I certainly would add whatever I can in my capacity to contribute. As someone who was around for all the hearings and meetings and reading all the documents way back when, there were a few things historically that I wanted to mention, and one was I seem to recall that, and I could be wrong about this, that the first listing really dealt with nitrogen and not nutrients in general, and that it was phosphorus was not listed, I believe, until 2002, and one of the motivating factors for that listing was a report that was done by a group called IOS, and one of the authors was previously in the room, on phosphorus occurrence in Santa Rosa's wastewater, and demonstrated that there was a large amount of phosphorus being discharged into the Laguna. I also think historically it's important to mention that for 25 years Santa Rosa was discharging huge amounts of wastewater with nutrients into the Laguna, up to 4 billion gallons a year, and also a large amount of irrigated wastewater, some of which may have run off into the Laguna in the summertime. My reason for mentioning that, and one of my concerns, is that although I'm not a scientist, I understand that the remaining coliforms in that those discharges could have bound up with the sediments and could be re-released over time. And I don't think I heard that mentioned as one of the things that was going to be looked at in terms of the pathogens. So I'd just like to mention that and, you know, see if it could be made part of the issue. At any rate, one thing I want to call attention to is that the small stretch between Guerneville and Monterio that's listed for pathogens, over about half of that area is sewered. And I think there should be a differentiation or some attempt to differentiate the pathogen situation in the sewered area versus the non-sewered area, because I know there's a lot of concern about what impact septics are having on the river. It certainly is complicated, but I just wanted to mention that. And I'm not sure, I didn't have a presentation made, but at any rate, I'll leave it there for now. And I would hope that we would be involved in any kind of citizen groups that get set up around this issue. We definitely want to be part of it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
First word and last word was horrendous.
Yeah. Staff, did you have anything to conclude? Or are we
good?
Okay. That's great. Any board member additional questions or comments? All right. Thank you very much. Need a break?
Are we done?
No, we still have a couple more things. We still have business.
Okay, you want to take a quick break? I want to get my hands on Kathy Goodwin.
Do you? Okay, board's going to take a 5-minute break.
Oh, yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
We good? Okay. Ms. Coleman.
Mr. Chair.
You have a report for us.
I do. I have a couple things that I wanted to mention to you. One is to let you know that I think you all know that the Klamath TMDL is going to be coming up in front of the State Board. I think the comment period closes fairly shortly, but I think it's the end of this month. They're looking at probably a hearing date in Sacramento. in early September. So that will still then allow EPA to meet the approval by the end of the year, which is the end of the consent decree. Also wanted to mention we had two dairy workshops, one down here in the southern part of the region and then one up north, and those both went really well. There's more outreach to be done, and particularly in the northern area, we need to be put more time into some relationship building. We've been, I think, quite successful in relationship building in the southern part of the region. Incredible help from the United Dairymen, and that continues, and they're committed to helping us also build better relationships up north with the RCDs. And also had a very, an absolutely excellent meeting with the, I'm going to say this wrong, his name is Jim Spear. He's the area manager for NRCS. Is that right, Heidi? Thank you. And one of his resource guys, and it was a really high energy, a lot of good exchange of information of how by pushing forward on the dairies, we can, working in partnership with NRCS, work, NRCS can then help the landowners, and they've got a team. And what was really encouraging to hear was one of the things the state conservationists would like to see is for the northern area to invest more in dairies. So it's kind of a nice coincidence of he's being pushed by his boss to, you know, do more outreach to dairies, and we're going to be doing the same thing. So that's going to be good for the landowners and then good for improving water quality in the long run. So that was pretty exciting on the dairy front.
Is that also NRCS, though, is the funnel to also USDA grant money, correct? Yeah, that's a good catch.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Along those lines, still thinking of cows here, one of the issues, as you know, with the U.S. Forest Service waiver that you adopted in June was the grazing issue. And we're happy to say we believe the comment period has the opportunity for anyone to petition that permit has passed and no petition was filed. So that slots that waiver into place. And for the next 5 years, and Bob Clamp has laid out an extensive program for doing outreach with the individual forests. Had a good meeting with Farm Bureau and the Cattlemen's Association to talk about what it meant to grazers, as well as, and he's laid out a program for meeting with the different Klamath, the different forests and the forest supervisors and their resource teams to triangulate on what the Forest Service waiver means and how it can be implemented and how we're going to work together to really make it work and shift where we are, where we have been, to something better in the future, which I think is everyone's interest. Third item was we are, end of the fiscal year, state fiscal year happened, and you know, we keep a list of numbers of commitments of different things that we commit to both EPA and the state board in terms of permits and inspections, et cetera. And overall, our numbers are quite good this year, I'm happy to report. And in the next executive officer report, when the data, all the data is entered into our computer system and then drawn out again, I'll have a report in the next executive officer's report of sort of tallying that in a more exact way, along with some of the more qualitative things that we've gotten done this year, some of our big accomplishments, and some of the things that aren't moving as fast as we'd like them to, like elk and freshwater TMDLs. Fourth thing is Willits Bypass. For those of you who haven't been following it, it's, well, everyone knows they drive through Willits. We all drive through Willits, and there is the Caltrans has been pushing forward a project for the bypass to be built. It's a huge project. It's the largest fill of wetlands, about 80 acres.
Wow.
Largest fill that the District Corps in San Francisco has seen in almost two decades. And because of the need to get the money sooner rather than later due to funding issues, Caltrans has pushed really hard and faster than to get their permits. For us, it's a 401 certification, and from the Corps, then it'll be a 404 permit. And they've pushed it really faster than they had the information available in order to do the kind of documentation that's required for a project of that magnitude. So we're all under the gun to get a certification done now by August 6th, and working pretty hard towards that. And I think that's going to be something that we'll be able to accomplish. It's going to be a conditional cert with a lot of extra requirements in it. And the Corps then will have to make a decision by the end of August whether or not they're going to permit the project at all. And that's the part that makes it very controversial, as you can imagine. We're talking about a lot of jobs, a lot of investment. So just leave it at that. And then
I ask a question on that? I realize if it's got a lot of momentum, that has to be dealt with. But what is the mitigation ratio? How close is the wetlands? And what's
they're not able to mitigate within the immediate area. So what they've proposed is a rather large mitigation project in the valley to the north. And part of the issue has been that Caltrans hasn't acquired all of the land yet. They're in final negotiations, and for the last big piece, in fact, are looking at condemnation. So one of the issues is they haven't tied up the land. They put it down in an endowment to manage the acreage, and I'm just blanking on what it is, but it's over 1,000 acres. It's a huge mitigation, both because it's not just wetland mitigation, it's also upland and enhancement.
Right, so. Well, it's also off-site, which is
and
a major...
And it's also off-site, which is problematic as well. And so as we said, all of the agencies said that since there physically wasn't anything available on-site, that we can't... The operating phrase is, we said to Caltrans, come back in and dazzle us with something. If we're going to have to basically bend the rules, we're going to need to be able to justify that in a way that is going to work. And and isn't creating new wetlands. So it's a good, conceptually, it's a really good project, conceptually. It's, you know, this is one of those things that the hard part are the details, and nailing the details down from the RCD needs to agree that they're going to manage the land. They need to know what the grazing management practices are going to be that will allow for wetland creation, continuation, and enhancement, and then get a lessee on board who's willing to follow that kind of a grazing plan. So, I mean, a whole lot of details that need to be worked through yet, and those are going to have to be conditions. The last item is we've got two retirements coming up. I think you probably know about both of them. Christine Wright Shacklett is going to be retiring. She's worked in probably all of the programs at some point in time, but basically has spent much of her career in timber and most recently in cleanups. And we're going to be sorry to see her go. And also Bob Clamp has announced his retirement effective in November. So it's going to be sad, but they look happy. What more can I say? And that's it, unless you have any questions for me.
Do we have replacements for these people? Are we going to get replacements in terms of state funding, or is this just attrition cuts us at the knees?
This is part of the plan of death by 1,000 paper cuts. Mm-hmm. We will, at this point, we've for both of them, because they're both supervisors, we will have people in their place, but they were not going to be able to hire to backfill. We've not been able to backfill the division chief for cleanups. We won't be able to have a real timber non-point source chief on board either. That leaves one division chief and Louise and myself to manage. So there are holes that we're not able to fill, and that's not just us. That's happening board-wide and, of course, state agency-wide and local government as well. It's just the way it is. Microphone.
Yeah. I'm sure you've heard this, but just for the basic reason is that we are we have had a number of cuts over the last year, and then this year we have a proposal of essentially a 10% what's called increase in salary savings from 5% to 10%. The way that we are budgeted, when you get a position, you get 95% of the money, because it's assumed that your recruitment and people leaving, that you only use 95% of your money on each position. Well, the governor has put in an executive order that says, no, we'll make it 10%. That means that we have to maintain a 10% vacancy rate to be able to do that. And our vacancy rate is about 7% right now. So we're short. I can't remember.
We're about usually run about 2%.
So you're running about 2%. So that's that means that for anyone that leaves until this gets straightened out, until you get above that 10%, they're not going to be ability to backfill that, because we do not, our commitment at State Board is that we do not want to go into a layoff mode. And if we can't maintain that 10%, we will be in a position of having to lay people off later on in the year. And that's just not something that we want to be doing to our employees. So it's not good news, but that's the reason it's there.
Mr. Chair, for members of the public that might be listening, the particularly in some organizations, many, many times, looking at Mr. Myers, many, many times I have heard you say that we need to put more people there, and you can understand the angst that we have as a group to get things done. And it's, I don't know what we do, but at one point you gave us some numbers that projected that the Navarro would be taken care of someplace in the 22nd century. And this is the, I don't know what we do, but I know that this is the problem we have, and it's been going on now for years, and this is just the culmination of it.
I think we need to adopt a no crybaby attitude, and just we need to figure out how to do business differently. We need to partner better with people than we have in the past. And I think there's a willingness to partner in a way that there hasn't been before, because everybody's kind of in the same boat. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I think it isn't foreseeable that we will be increasing or even going flat for a while yet. And I think we just need to buckle up and be brave.
Thank you. Well, let's combine 11 and 12. Do we have any requests for future agenda items or other items?